stretched to launch a quick counterattack. "Relax," Martin said. "He didn't know we were coming." The wizards dropped lightly to the ground and dropped their guards. Gary looked over the group, took a moment to do some mental math, and reached for his staff, a long, gnarled piece of dark wood with action figures of the members of KISS lashed to its top.
"I might still have time to get something ready before Gwen, Philip, and Britt get here."
Martin held up a hand to stop him. "Philip and Britt aren't coming. Gwen's deliberately late to make it clear that she's not happy with me right now." Gwen appeared. She looked around the room. Only after she'd made eye contact and exchanged friendly greetings with every other wizard did she deign to look at Martin.
"Where are Britt and Philip?"
"I didn't invite them. Why not?" Gwen asked.
"We'll get to that." "Since you're all here," Gary said, "how about some snacks?"
Roy said, "Sure." Martin said, "None for me, thanks." Gary clapped twice in quick succession. Hubert said,
"Yes, Master, what should I make for your guests?"
All of the wizards turned and looked at Hubert, in his tuxedo jacket and mottled white and brown cotton gloves. Tyler asked,
"Hubert, what are you doing?"
Hubert puffed his chest out with pride.
"The Master has agreed to let me be his butler."
"It's butler, Hubert," said Gary.
"Yes, that! Who would like something to eat? It shouldn't take me long to whip something up."
The entire group made immediate, emphatic statements to the effect that they were not hungry. Gary shook his head.
"Okay, Hubert, false alarm. How's my burrito coming?"
"I'll put it in your demonic heat box as instructed. It should be done soon."
"Good. We have wizard secrets to discuss. You can go outside for a break."
Hubert backed out of the room, exiting to the vestibule that led to the outside world, bowing and closing the door as he left. Jeff looked utterly disgusted.
"He came to you to learn magic, and you're using him as a servant?"
"A properly microwaved burrito is kind of magical. Besides, there's no shame in being a butler."
"He's not a butler,"
Tyler said.
"A butler oversees the household staff. Hubert's your valet. They were also sometimes called a gentleman's gentleman. They tended to a nobleman's personal needs. The butler managed the household staff."
"Oh," Gary said. "I'm still gonna call him my butler. Butlers are just cooler. Like that, well, what's his name? Jeeves."
Tyler squeezed his eyes shut.
"Jeeves was Bertie Wooster's valet, not his butler."
Gwen put a hand on Tyler's shoulder.
"You understand that nobody cares, right?"
Martin cleared his throat.
"Let's get down to business. I suppose you're all wondering why I called you here."
Roy raised his hand, but didn't wait to be called on.
"Was it so you didn't have a chance to say, 'I suppose you're all wondering why I called you here?'"
"I have always wanted to say that, but no."
Gwen said,
"I assumed it was because you wanted to apologize to me."
"I didn't just call you, I called everybody.
I assumed you wanted to apologize in front of everybody."
"Why?"
Gary asked.
"What did he do?"
Gwen glared at Martin.
"He knows."
Gary smiled and stepped closer to Gwen.
"Hey, if you and Martin are on the outs, just let me say that if you decided to give me a whirl, I promise I'd never have any intention of marrying you."
Gwen rolled her eyes.
"I'm leaving." "Wait," Martin said. "This is important. It's not about you and me. It's about Philip."
Jeff raised his hand and spoke without waiting to be called on.
"Is that why you didn't invite him or Britt? So you could talk smack about Philip behind his back? Because you should know I'm totally going to tell him everything you say."
"No, it's not that. And please don't tell him. In fact, I picked Gary's place for this meeting because I knew it was one place that neither he nor Britt would ever turn up on their own. There's no way either of them would ever come here without a damn good reason."
"Hey," Gary said,
"that's hurtful. That doesn't mean it's not true. I wanted to talk to you all because I believe Philip is in danger. He's been attacked twice now, and he won't take it seriously."
Gwen asked, "Why not?"
"He doesn't believe he's been attacked."
"They can't have been very vicious attacks then,"
Roy said.
"They weren't, but they're escalating, and I know who's behind it."
"Okay," Roy said. "That sounds serious. Tell us exactly what happened."
"Well, okay," Martin said. "The first time, there was a knock on the door. When Philip opened it, There was nobody there, but some kids were walking away with a package that was meant for him, and I saw someone lurking in the shadows across the street.
Gwen said, I remember that. That was last night.
So you can back him up on this?
Roy asked. No, Gwen said flatly. I didn't see any of that stuff. I just remember him arguing with Philip about it. Wasn't the guy across the street someone wearing a Star Wars costume?
Philip said he looked like a Jawa, but he didn't even see the guy.
Martin flapped his hands away as if shooing off a bee.
Okay, fine. Yeah, I admit that one's not very convincing. But just now, in Atlantis, I saw the same guy, and he definitely attacked Philip.
Okay, Roy said. What did he do?
You know the kid's game Mousetrap? He made a real-life version of that to trap Philip.
So he's captured Philip? Gwen asked.
No.
So it didn't work?
No, it worked. The cage came down on him, but he was able to get out really easily. Then I chased the guy. He had a head like a goblin. I'm pretty sure it was a mask. That or he's just real ugly. Anyway, he sicked a flock of birds on me.
Tyler turned to Gwen.
Man, when you two are fighting, he really goes off the rails, doesn't he?
Gwen said, Martin, if you really believe that Philip is in danger, shouldn't you be talking to him?
I did. He doesn't believe me. But just say I'm right and Philip is being attacked. They're subtle and non-lethal attacks, but he's being attacked nonetheless by a magic user. I met him. Look at what he did to my robe.
Yeah, Gwen said, I noticed. And I'm not going to fix that for you.
I didn't ask. Bigger fish to fry. While the attacks haven't been dangerous yet, that we know of, do we want to wait around and wait to see if that changes?
Tyler held up a finger to stop Martin.
Let me see if I understand. You're saying that a shadowy figure has attacked Philip twice, in ways that are so subtle and indirect that he doesn't recognize them as attacks, even after you pointed them out to him. Is that the gist of it?
Yes.
And what do you want from us?
Martin looked at the others as if they'd lost their minds.
To help me stop it!
Stop what? Roy asked. The almost nothing that probably isn't happening? It seems like you should be able to handle that yourself. We're not the ones to help with this anyway. If Philip's the one in danger, he's the one you should be talking to. And if he won't listen, Britt the Younger would be the next logical choice.
Yeah, but I already talked to Philip and all he did was mock me. If I go to Britt the Younger, what's she gonna do? First thing is she'll tell Philip, then they'll both mock me. So you came to us so we could mock you?
Gary asked.
No, I came to you because I hoped, foolishly, that at least one of you might want to help me.
I'll help you, Gwen said.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I'll give you the best kind of help there is. A suggestion.
That's the best kind of help?
Yes, from my point of view. Because it lets me feel like I did something without putting out much effort, anyway. I suggest that you're a time traveler, Use that to your advantage. Go forward in time and ask some future version of Philip who was attacking him and why. If it turns out he was in danger, he'll be happy to tell you, so that you can come back and save him. If he isn't in danger, future him will get a good laugh out of it. Either way, you'll have helped him.
Martin started to respond, but stopped short when the wizards all heard shouting at the outer door that opened from Gary's antechamber with its large stone altar to the mouth of Skull Gullet Cave. Gary called out, Hubert! Hubert hustled in from the entrance and bowed deeply.
Master, I am sorry.
What is it?
People to speak to you, Master. I told them to go away, but they refused.
What do they want?
I'd much rather they told you.
Gary crossed through his antechamber, and all of the other wizards followed. Three young men from the village were standing outside the ornately carved stone door. One was a hog mucker, another was a fish gutter, and the third was a hide scraper at the local tannery. Martin didn't know any of their names, but he recognized their smells.
What can I do for you?
Gary asked. All three of the young men fell to their knees. The hide scraper pleaded,
Train us, O Master, like you're training Hubert.
Gary pinched the bridge of his nose.
Hubert, didn't I order you not to tell anybody about our arrangement?
Yes, Master, you did.
And did you tell anybody?
I might have mentioned it to someone, Master.
And by might have, you mean...
I definitely did, Master.
And by someone, you mean?
Them, Master.
Hubert pointed at the three men on their knees, beseeching Gary to train them.
So you definitely told these three men about our arrangement after I ordered you not to.
I wouldn't say that, Master.
But it's true.
Oh, yes.
10. Philip teleported home from Brit the Elder's, his heart heavy with woe and his brain buzzing with problems. He materialized outside the door of Brit the Younger's apartment. Her living space connected to his, despite the tremendous distance and time differentials that separated them. And he thought of her apartment in Atlantis, the building that held his office, and his hut on the outskirts of Ledchurch as one large dwelling. Philip reckoned he'd left Brit the Younger's nearly 2 hours earlier, a long time to just be gone for a walk. Brit would definitely ask him where he'd been, and while he fully intended to tell her, he wanted to do it on his terms. He needed to grease the skids, ease into it, then tell Brit the Younger, his Brit, everything. But he had to make it clear that she must keep her distance. She couldn't interact with Brit the Elder until everything was resolved, because it might just cause the entire universe to crash. He had reason to hope she would be fine with that. She didn't like Brit the Elder anyway. Philip did some quick mental math and rough Esperanto translation, then said,
Reru, unu duonan, horan.
Philip seemed to remain stationary, but the sun, the shadows, and the people milling around on the street outside all changed. He took a final quiet moment to prepare himself. Then, technically only 30 minutes after he left, Philip entered the apartment. He found Brit the Younger exactly where he'd left her, curled up in her favorite reading chair. She glanced up from her book and smiled. You weren't gone long.
I suppose I wasn't. How's the book?
Interesting. But Capoeira isn't exactly what I hoped it would be. Nick leaned out from the kitchen.
Philip, do you have the chicken?
Philip moaned and rolled his eyes at his own stupidity.
I'm sorry, I forgot your chicken. I'll pop out and get you one in just a moment.
Nick said, Oh, don't worry about it. I need to go get a few other things anyway.
Oh, good. Still, sorry about that, Nick.
I forgive you.
Thank you,
Philip said. Then after a long pause, he turned back to Brit the Younger.
Look, I'd like to talk to you about something.
Been doing some thinking, eh? Fine. Brit closed her book, placed it on her lap, and looked up at Philip, still smiling. Philip said,
It's about Brit the Elder.
Oh. Brit's smile withered and died. She picked the book back up, opened it, and went back to reading. I don't want to talk about her, she said, quietly, almost as if to herself. Philip said,
I know she's not your favorite person.
Brit the Younger snorted, not my favorite person. When I'm in a great mood and she's just done something nice for me, she's not my favorite person. Right now, she's pretty close to my least favorite. Even when she decides to be helpful, she does it in the least helpful way possible, then acts like she's some kind of saint for it. You know how when we were off fighting the dragon, she helped Louisa with the wounded?
Yes, I thought that was quite kind of her. For someone with no medical training to jump in and help Atlantis's only trained doctor deal with a flood of injuries from a dragon attack, I'd say that's commendable.
That was. What was less commendable is that she refused to tell me how she helped. So when I'm her, I'll have to figure it out for myself. And she talked Louise into not telling me either. Then she had the gall to come in here, into my home, to gloat about the fact that she wasn't going to tell me. And to top it all off, just because she thought it was fun, she decided to mess with me a little bit, pretending to remember something wrong just to give me a moment of hope that I might not turn into her someday, all so she could have the fun of snatching that hope away.
Philip stood, looking down at Brit the Younger, stunned into silence by the unexpected ferocity of her response.
Wait a second, Brit said, rising to her feet and dropping her book to the floor. Did she contact you?
No, she hasn't,
Philip noted that. Strictly speaking, this was not a lie.
Good, because if I thought even for a second that she was somehow interfering in our relationship, I'd have to go track her down and give her a few choice pieces of my mind.
Do you mean a few choice words or a piece of my mind? You sort of combine the two.
Yeah, because I'm mad enough to do both at the same time. Seriously, Philip, Tell me if she's bothering you. Oh, I'd love an excuse to go over there.
Philip remembered Britt the Elder's warning that any direct interaction between herself and Britt the Younger could hasten or indeed cause the destruction of the entire universe as they knew it. Philip put what he desperately hoped was a calming hand on Britt the Younger's shoulder.
No, Britt. There's no need to do that. She hasn't contacted me.
Britt took a moment to calm herself.
Sorry I got so worked up. It's just, Philip, you're the one thing I have that she doesn't. Our relationship is kind of the only thing that's really mine. If she did something that messed it up for me, I don't know what I'd do.
I understand.
Good.
So, you wanted to discuss Britt the Elder? What's on your mind?
Just that I think it might be for the best if we both avoid her for a while.
Britt the Younger smiled. Fine by me. What brought that on?
Just that, while I was on my walk, I realized how much happier you are when you don't have to deal with her.
Britt picked her book up off the floor and returned to her chair. Good call. I agree to your plan of avoiding my least favorite person. That's a very good idea, Philip. I find that a nice walk can be a good chance to think.
Yes,
Philip said.
I suspect I'll be taking a lot more walks in the future.
Martin stood in the séance room of his workspace in medieval London, a large square room with velvet-draped walls, decorated with four large statues in each corner of the room, facing inward. If one of the locals came looking for Martin's wizardly help, he would identify the four statues as the old gods and the new. But anyone from Martin's time would easily recognize them as Optimus Prime, Boba Fett, Grimace, and the Stig. Martin opened the small silver box that disguised the Android smartphone he used to run macros and manipulate the file. He picked a time about 6 months into the future and ran a search. When he found Philip's location, he initiated travel through both time and space. Martin got the momentary impression of being in a smallish, darkish room with one other person, but only for a fraction of a second. Before his eyes could even adjust to the new light level, he transported again, this time against his will and with no control over the destination. Martin found himself standing alone among rows and rows of theater seats, their wooden bottoms folded upward. Martin looked around the room but saw nobody else on the main floor. The balcony and luxury boxes above also seemed empty. The stage curtains were drawn shut. Martin appeared to have the theater to himself. Two powerful spotlights turned on with a mechanical ka-chunk. Brilliant white cones of light shone down from the upper reaches of the theater, illuminating two seemingly random portions of the stage curtain. Martin heard the sound of pulleys turning and rope stretching. The curtain separated, receding to the sides of the stage with surprising speed, revealing two figures in full tuxedos, complete with top hat, tails, and white-tipped walking sticks.
Oh, Lord,
Martin moaned.
Yes,
one of the gentlemen said, spreading his arms wide.
I am forced to surmise, from your emotional exaltation, that you have come to the stunning realization that you are to be the lone witness to a private performance by those magnificent magicians, those preeminent prestidigitators, those accomplished alliterators, yours truly, the sensational Sid, and my cooperative counterpart, the great Gilbert.
Gilbert waved. Hi, Martin. Martin said,
guys, can we just...
Sid brought the tip of his ivory-tipped walking stick down onto the stage floor with a loud bang.
Please! Out of respect for the dignity of the performance, we ask that you hold all questions and comments for the end of the show, when I promise they will be disregarded in due course. Now, at long last and at great personal expense, we present to you a special trick, custom designed for the occasion, entitled Philip's Personal Message to Martin on the occasion of Martin's leap to the future to discuss possible danger to Philip's well-being, posed by what appears to be an angry Jawa.
Gilbert said,
We spent a lot more time designing the illusion than we did thinking of a snappy name.
Indeed.
Sid said.
And that surplus of effort on the one will show as vibrantly as the lack of effort about the other, I assure you.
Martin glared at both of them, but folded down a seat and settled in to watch the performance. From somewhere off stage, Martin heard what sounded like a small, poorly rehearsed band playing the final countdown by Europe. Martin shouted, "Arrested Development! Very nice!" Gilbert smiled and tipped his top hat. Two assistants, wearing hooded black velvet robes and white porcelain masks to obscure their faces, came out on stage. One pushed a large steamer trunk on wheels. The other pulled a 15-foot-wide red curtain hanging from a wheeled frame. With much unnecessary rhythmic arm-waving, one assistant opened the trunk. The other reached into the trunk and produced two more robes, which Gilbert and Sid put on in a needlessly dancy manner, whipping them around as much as possible in the process. The assistant then handed them two masks, the same as the white ones the assistants wore, except that Sid's was bright red and Gilbert's bright blue. The two magicians threw their hats and canes off into the wings, put up their hoods, and the trick began in earnest. Gilbert, in the blue mask, stepped into the open trunk and knelt down, while Sid in the red mask pushed the lid closed, sealing him in. Sid wrapped the trunk with a chain, which he fastened with a cartoonishly large padlock. One assistant spun the trunk while the other pulled the rolling curtain in front of it, blocking Martin's view. Sid and the two white-masked assistants pranced rhythmically in a circle around the rolling curtain and the hidden trunk for a few bars. The two assistants moved the rolling curtain off to the side, then they both sprinted into the wings and out of sight. In the center of the stage, Sid, in his red mask and hooded cloak, waved his hands over the trunk. The lid of the trunk shook, then opened a crack, straining against the chain. A pair of hands worked their way out through the gap, holding two thin metal implements, and began working on picking the lock. Sid ran to the rear of the stage and darted behind the rolling curtain. As the padlock sprung open and fell to the floor, the curtain also fell, revealing that Sid had vanished. The trunk sprang open and Sid stood up from inside, having somehow transported from behind the screen into the trunk. Sid removed his red mask and hood, held his arms out wide, and turned around, revealing a message embroidered into the back of his robe.
"Martin, you're embarrassing yourself. Just drop it. Philip."
From behind him, Martin heard a voice say,
"Good bit of advice there, I reckon."
Martin turned to see Gilbert sitting in the row behind him, looking exaggeratedly relaxed, leaned back with his feet kicked up on the back of the seat next to Martin.
"Uh-huh," Martin said without enthusiasm. "Did you think this whole thing was going to impress me? You realize I can teleport from place to place, too."
"Yeah,"
Gilbert said.
"But the impressive bit is that we didn't. What you just saw was all illusion. No actual magic involved."
"None?" "None," Sid said. "All misdirection and a trick padlock. We run an honest magic show, using the traditional methods of deception and trickery."
"That's right," Gilbert said. "Instead of cheating the audience by using real magic like some people we could name."
He lightly kicked Martin in the shoulder for emphasis.
"I don't do a magic show."
"Yet,"
Gilbert said.
"Whatever. So I assume Philip put you up to all this?"
Sid nodded.
"Correct. And he didn't give you any information other than that I should drop it?"
"And that you're embarrassing yourself," Gilbert added, "which we could have seen for ourselves."
"Fine. I'll just have to go find Philip somewhere and somewhen else and talk to him there."
Martin stood up, pulled his ornate silver box out of his pocket, opened it, jabbed his finger angrily at the screen of his smartphone, and disappeared. 5 seconds later, Martin reappeared in the exact spot he'd just left.
"Damn it!"
Sid smiled broadly.
"Yes! Philip set up a macro that will redirect you here if you try to contact him in the future. Now, if you'll just turn your back for a second, we'll reset the trick and do it again."
Martin glared at Sid, poked a few more times at his smartphone, and disappeared. After 15 seconds of waiting, Gilbert said,
"I think he's gone for good this time."
One of the two assistants walked out onto the stage from the wings. He pulled off his mask, revealing that he was a teenage boy with sandy brown hair. The crumpled mass of the rolling curtain shifted seemingly on its own, then slid to the side as a trap door hinged open and the other assistant, now wearing a red mask, climbed out. She removed the red mask, the white mask underneath it, and her hood. She looked close to the same age as the boy and bore an undeniable family resemblance, although she sported a thick mass of wavy jet black hair.
"So that was him," Sid said. "What did you think?"
"He was so young,"
the girl said. "And angry," the boy added. "Really angry." Sid nodded.
"Indeed. I'm sure he's mellowed with age. Most men do."
The boy said,
"They get wiser and stop letting things bother them?"
"No," Gilbert said. "Things bother them more. It's just they don't have the energy to act on it like they used to."
11. Philip leaned around the doorframe into Britt the Younger's bedroom in a manner he had designed and mentally rehearsed to appear casual and spur of the moment.
"Hey, I'm going to go for a walk."
Britt the Younger turned away from her yellowed original Macintosh computer and looked toward Philip.
"Okay."
Philip's eyes narrowed.
"Okay?"
"Yeah," Britt said, turning back to her computer. "Okay, whatever. Hey, before you go..."
"Yes?"
"Can you think of an example of a way that people write down and communicate a series of physical movements so that they can teach them to another person?"
"What, do you mean, like, dance choreography?"
"Yeah, that's the example I came up with. I also thought of drills and square dancing, but those are still kinds of dance. I'm just wondering if there's a better fit. Can you think of another?"
Philip thought for a moment. "I guess musical notation would fit that description. The musicians have to do the same things at the same time every time."
"Yeah, that's not bad. It's still music-based, but still interesting. Thanks. Have fun."
"What?"
"On your walk? Have fun." Philip shrugged.
"Okay."
Philip walked through the living room where Nick was doing the dusting. Philip said,
"I'm just popping out for a quick walk. Need me to grab a chicken for you? I promise I'll do it this time."
"I told you don't worry about the chicken, Philip. It wasn't a problem. If you like, you could get me some butter."
"Butter? Done."
Philip stepped out the door. Martin watched as Philip emerged from Britt the Younger's front door, looking distracted and in a hurry. Preoccupied as he was, Philip didn't notice the unusually light foot traffic. He had the entire section of path completely to himself. Philip also failed to notice the fact that while it was a beautiful cloudless day, there was a dark shadow directly over him, blotting out the sun and growing larger. Had he noticed the shadow, he might have looked up and seen the large black trapezoid streaking down out of the sky directly toward him. The dark mass fell silently, then came to an instant stop 30 feet above Philip's head. He remained oblivious, walked down the path, stepped into a blind alley between two buildings, then teleported away. Martin stood motionless on the roof of a nearby building, his staff outstretched, projecting the force field holding the object in midair. He twirled the staff in tiny circles, causing the object to spin. As he spun the object, Martin saw writing engraved into one side that said, 16 tons. Martin looked around and saw only one other person present, lurking in the alley between two buildings across the way. Luckily, it was the person Martin was hoping to find.
"Pants dried out, I trust?" Martin said.
The goblin stepped out of the shadows, looked up at Martin, and lowered his hood, revealing his bald head, pointed ears, and inhumanly sharp teeth.
"I assume so. I took them off rather than letting them dry on me."
"I hear doing that with jeans makes them fit better."
"I was wearing slacks."
"A goblin in slacks?"
"Dress for the job you want, not the one you have. I see you haven't repaired your robe after my feathered friends used you as a seed bell."
"Yeah, I kind of like it this way," Martin said. "It feels more broken in. So, look, about this 16-ton weight you just tried to drop on Philip, I gotta say, I'm not happy with you about it. Although you do score some points for the Monty Python reference."
"Thanks. I considered going with a giant foot, but I found the little fart sound distasteful.
Martin nodded and flicked his staff upward. The 16-ton weight flew back up into the sky, disappearing over the city's edge and splashing down in the ocean.
I sort of expected you to stick with the board game motif. I worried we'd find Philip dead with a wishbone-shaped hole in his sternum and a glowing, buzzing nose.
I'm not trying to kill him, Martin. I don't want to kill anybody. That's why I blocked this section of the path off today so there'd be no bystanders. We both know Philip's invulnerable. The only danger your friend is in is danger of getting distracted. That's what I'm trying to do. And in the end, I'd be doing him a favor.
If that's true, tell me what you're distracting him from. If you're telling the truth, maybe I can help.
No, Martin. I have to handle this on my own. Speaking of which...
The goblin started waving his arms in the same showy manner he had when he made the ravens attack Martin.
I'm not accomplishing anything standing here arguing with you, so...
Martin thrust the head of his staff toward the goblin and said, Pika Pulvaro! Cutting him off mid-sentence. A sparkling white light radiated from the bust of Santo at the top of Martin's staff, illuminating the goblin. He stopped swinging his arms, stood still for half a second, then let out a high, anguished moan and started furiously scratching himself.
What'd you do?
Martin smiled.
I learned from our last encounter. I decided to forget embarrassment as a weapon and start using discomfort. You're the first person to experience my new itch ray. Now, tell me, what's going on? Or, it's about to get real humid. I'm talking Florida in July humid.
You're clever, Martin, but you forgot one thing.
What?
Just because I'm itchy doesn't mean I can't do magic.
The goblin whipped his arms around in a series of wide gestures, then went back to furiously scratching himself. Martin heard a strange noise, more an assortment of noises that combined oddly. There was a base layer of scrabbling, scraping noises, with a counterpoint of squeaking and a dull undertone of rustling, all which got louder with each passing second. It was like a combination of the sound of nails on a chalkboard and two pieces of styrofoam rubbing against each other. It seemed to come from below the building on which he was standing. As it grew louder, Martin couldn't help but step closer to the edge to see what was making the awful noise. He saw nothing on the ground below, but as he looked, a wave of brown and gray lumps poured over the roof's front edge and advanced toward him. His primitive instincts identified what they were well before he got a good look at them. They were rats, hundreds of rats, surging toward him. As the rats formed a swirling pool around his feet, Martin fought down the urge to flee and indulged his urge to talk smack.
You just gonna try swarming me with different animals until something works? Not a great plan.
I agree, the goblin said. Luckily, that's not what I'm doing.
Really? That's what it looks like from here.
Is it? Then why haven't the rats climbed up your legs yet?
Martin looked down at the rats, which, as the goblin said, had yet to make any effort to climb onto him. Instead, they remained in a writhing heap, crowded all around his feet, their wiry pink tails stuck in the air as they gnawed on the surface beneath him. The roof on which Martin was standing gave way, weakened by the chewing and broken by the combined weight of him and the rats. As he fell into the shop beneath, he had only a fraction of a second to register that the Atlanteans inside stood on any furniture they could as a swirling circle of rodents gnawed at the floor. Martin landed on the rats, crashed through the floor, and fell to another pool of rats below. He broke through that floor, landed on more rats, crashed through again, landed on more rats, crashed through again, and finally came to a rest where Atlantis's solid diamond outer wall finally curved inward enough for him and the rats to land on it and slide to a stop. Martin sat, growling for a second, then held his staff out above him and flew straight up through all of the holes he'd just created until he erupted back out into the open air, a cloud of rats flying in all directions. He flew through the air in a graceful arc, landing in front of the goblin with enough force to crack the paving stones beneath his feet.
Oh, you're back,
the goblin said.
I probably should have just split, but I kind of wanted to see the look on your face. Anyway, you were gone just long enough for me to call a friend.
Far above the city, up in the sky, Martin heard an eardrum-shattering shriek. Martin looked up and saw an eagle. At first, he thought the eagle was quite close to him, but then he realized it only looked close because it was the size of a small airplane. It almost seemed to flap its wings in slow motion as it descended, still screeching at an ear-splitting volume. As it drew near, it thrust out talons, each the size of a small child wielding kitchen knives, beckoning for a hug. Martin hunched down, held his staff above him with one arm, and produced a hemispherical force field he hoped would keep him safe. He squeezed his eyes shut and waited for the attack. He heard the screeching and felt the subsonic beating of the giant wings draw closer, sail directly overhead, then recede, as if the bird had merely passed over him. He opened his eyes to follow the immense eagle and watched as it gently plucked the goblin up in its talons before climbing back into the sky. The goblin smiled broadly and waved at Martin, shouting,
"You thought the eagle was here for you? Jeez! Self-absorbed much!"
Just seconds before, Martin had been cowering, dreading the giant eagle's attack. Now Martin took off, flying after the eagle, trying to catch up as quickly as possible. As he gained, he kept his eyes on the goblin clinging to the eagle's claws, nothing but blue sky and the sea behind him, looking at Martin with a mixture of amusement and confusion on his face, still scratching the small of his back with his free hand. As Martin drew within shouting range, the goblin asked,
"How long is this itching gonna last?
An hour or so?"
"Why, what do you think it accomplishes? It didn't stop me from doing anything."
"Not yet, but you'll think twice about messing with me again, knowing that there's an hour of itching in it for you."
"I wasn't messing with you to begin with."
"You were messing with Philip. Anyone who messes with Philip gets messed with by me."
The goblin laughed.
"I know," Martin said. "Passive voice. I'm working off the top of my head here."
The goblin kept laughing.
"It's not that. Bad style is the least of what's making you sound stupid right now."
"Whatever. Hey, if you can do magic and you wanted to get away, why not just teleport out? Why mess around with the whole giant eagle thing?"
"Showmanship is very important. But if it's all wasted on you..."
Martin shouted,
"No, wait!"
But it was too late. The goblin teleported away. The giant eagle faded out of existence, leaving Martin flying alone. He slowed to a stop, hovered in empty space above the Mediterranean Sea, then teleported himself back to Atlantis. 12. Philip materialized in Britt the Elder's home and found her sitting at the exact same Macintosh he'd left Britt the Younger sitting at before, although now it was an even darker shade of yellow.
"How are your feet?"
"The same, and it's spread up my calves."
"Sorry to hear that." "Look, I'm happy to help you," Philip said, "but I must say I really don't like lying to Britt about it."
"It's only lying if you tell her something that's not true. I suggest you don't tell her anything at all unless she asks."
"So you want me to act aloof and mysterious?"
"Is it worse than being dishonest?"
"Either way, if she ever finds out that I'm sneaking around behind her back, especially to go meet with you, I'm afraid it'll be the end of my relationship."
Britt the Elder stood up. "I know. I've given that some thought. We need to move our activities somewhere other than Atlantis. Even though we're staying holed up in my home, there's still too much of a chance that we'll slip up and tip our hand. We need to go somewhere there are resources and people who can help us, but where nobody would think to look for us."
"I assume you have a place in mind?"
"Of course. Come along, I'll show you." Britt the Elder put her left hand on Philip's shoulder, then, with her right, swiped through several menus in a floating interface that only she could see, and made a selection. Britt the Elder's home faded away, replaced by a single unkempt room. Unpainted, unplastered sheetrock lined the walls, and thin, well-worn carpeting covered what felt like a concrete slab floor with no carpet padding. In one corner, two folding lawn chairs flanked a card table with a bent leg. The opposite corner was filled with a set of bunk beds, made from unfinished 2x4s and sheets of splintery plywood. Philip inhaled and instantly regretted it. He reeled as his lungs struggled to separate what usable oxygen it could from the combined aromas of pipe smoke, fish guts, and stale body odor.
Where are we? He gasped.
A hunting shack in Alaska, 1984. She had to speak up to be heard over the wind rushing through the forest outside. Philip rushed to the window, but all he saw through it was trees and snow. He opened the window, hoping to get some fresh air, which he did. Fresh, freezing cold air. The offensive smell of the cabin flushed out of his nasal cavity, replaced by the searing pain of an instant brain freeze. He tried to slam the window closed, but the ancient and ill-maintained sash jammed in the frame and only came unstuck with great effort. Britt the Elder said, "I bought the shack and all of the land in a 10-mile radius from two guys who called themselves Pinky and Spud. I put up force fields so that nobody can get anywhere near here, even if they had any reason to want to, which they don't." Once he'd wrestled the window closed, Philip inhaled again, grimacing. He looked around the interior of the shack a second time.
"When you said we were going somewhere with resources, this isn't what I pictured."
"This isn't our final destination, just a way station. We're going to the year 2018.
"I can't," Philip said. "I'm from 1986, and we can only travel forward in time as far as the latest point we've already been to."
"Yes, I know. Please come here." Philip stepped away from the window toward the middle of the room.
"The only way to go any further ahead is to go back to your original time and let history flow forward on its own. That's why we aren't all visiting the future all the time."
Britt the Elder said, "Yes, I know all of that. We all know that. We know it so well that we never bother to question it or try to think of a way around it."
"A way around it? Like what?"
Britt smiled. "Like this." She placed a hand on Philip's forehead and swiped her other hand through a floating menu only she could see. Britt the Elder disappeared before Philip's eyes, but he barely noticed. The sound of the weather in the forest outside rose sharply in pitch, climbing out of audible range and into a zone on the edge of his perception, where he experienced them as a sort of tickling deep in his ear canals instead of as sounds. The light coming in through the windows stuttered and strobed, almost like a steady beat, but with flashes of differing intensities and durations. They came so quickly, almost heaping on top of each other in an unpredictable manner, that Philip feared they might cause some sort of seizure, if he wasn't having one already. Every inch of Philip's skin tingled. He felt as if he was burning, or freezing, or both, in rapid succession, over and over again. The feeling would have been overwhelming on its own, blotting out all capacity for thought. When combined with the assaults on his eyes and ears as well, it was a set of sensations that went beyond the mere pleasant or unpleasant. He was incapable of processing the experience. His brain could only note it and hope to make sense of it at some other time. Later, he would describe it as being like the Stargate sequence from 2001 A Space Odyssey, only much faster and not stupefyingly boring. The entire ordeal took 10 seconds, then it was over. Philip blinked at the steady stream of grayish light streaming in the window. He noted that the wind seemed quieter than it had before. He removed his hands from his ears, and the sound grew a bit louder. He became aware that he was standing on his left foot with his right leg drawn up toward his chest. Both of his arms were pulled into his sides, and his shoulders were hunched over in a sort of full-body cringe. Philip was most grateful that his skin seemed back to normal. He looked at the backs of his hands and found them obscured by a thick layer of dust and draped with multiple layers of cobwebs. Philip shrieked, jumped, flapped his arms, and hopped around the room, flailing his every extremity in an attempt to shake off as much of the dust and as many of the spiderwebs as possible. After 2 high-speed laps of the room, he stopped, instead hopping in place and brushing the mess off of his limbs as fast as he could, until he finally stood, panting and still filthy, in a cloud of the discarded debris that floated in the still air, much of which just settled back on him anyway. Britt the Elder appeared in the center of the room, where she'd been before Philip's brief ordeal.
"Welcome to the year 2018. As you may have figured out, I slowed down your perception of time so that 34 years passed in what felt to you like 10 seconds.
Philip looked at her with an expression of mingled anger and betrayal, but could only manage to make a sort of plaintive moan. Britt the Elder nodded and looked at the floor.
"Yes, I know.
The experience is surprisingly traumatic, isn't it? I'm sorry about that. I went through the same thing when I had to leap from my time, 1996, to now. Lord knows what all I missed. I can tell you, jumping from 1984 like you did, you missed Tiny Toons, Animaniacs, and Freakazoid.
Could have warned me,
Philip grunted. Philip, dear, do you really think anticipating that would have made it any more pleasant?
You could have sent me in my sleep.
And you really believe you would have slept through it? You'd have woken up terrified. No, this was the best way, and it's over now. You're in the future. We can move on to our actual destination. She reached out to take Philip's arm, then, looking at the dust and tattered cobwebs covering his sleeve, thought better of it. She touched him gingerly with one finger and initiated another teleport. The flat gray light and musty air of the hunting shack gave way to the fluorescent light and overly conditioned air of a public servant's office. Philip blinked repeatedly as he saw Britt the Elder still standing beside him, and another Brit standing in front of the desk in a sharp, exquisitely tailored black pantsuit.
"Philip," Brit the Much Elder said. "Hey, welcome. Good to see you."
She took a moment to look Philip over from head to toe, then turned to Brit the Elder and said,
"Though I wish I were seeing him a little cleaner."
"He was much dirtier than this before," Brit the Elder said. "He was literally standing in a cloud, like Pigpen."
Philip said,
"I'm sorry. I don't think we've been introduced. I mean, I know we've met, in a sense. You're Brit, obviously, but you're not Brit the Elder, and you're not Brit the Younger."
Brit the Much Elder's smile recharged, but she shook her head.
"I am Brit the Younger, and I'm Brit the Elder. We're all the same, like you know, the same person, even if you don't want to admit it. But in a way, you're right. I'm not your Brit the Younger. I can't be. She doesn't know anything about any of this. Does she?"
"Philip, please tell me you haven't told her about any of this."
"I haven't, I promise. But I have to say I wasn't happy about it before, and am even less so now that I see you both. I mean, you tell me that I can't tell her because she's another you, and it turns out you already told another you."
Brit the Elder said, "Yes, but that just makes it all the more dangerous for you to tell a third of me." Philip shook his head.
"I don't like lying to her."
"We know," Brit the Much Elder said, "and we don't like the idea of you lying to her either. We are both her, after all. But if it's any consolation, we've forgiven you."
"Yes," Brit the Elder said. "Now, I think it'd be a good idea if we showed Philip to our workspace."
"Yeah, I think so," Brit the Much Elder said. "See you there."
Brit the Elder disappeared. Brit the Much Elder started for the door, then paused, looking at Philip.
"We're about to go out in front of people from the 21st century. The wizard get-up might freak them out a bit."
Philip removed his dusty, cobweb-covered robe and hat and draped them over the back of a chair. He leaned his staff against the side of the desk as well, and turned to face Brit the Much Elder in what he usually wore under his robe, his Union Jack sneakers, a pair of jeans and a black t-shirt bearing a picture of a dark red customized hot rod, and the words ZZ Top, Eliminator. He looked down at himself and asked,
"Will this work?"
Brit the Much Elder smiled.
"Sure. Every girl's crazy about a sharp-dressed man. Shall we?"
She opened the door and beckoned Philip to follow her. The instant they left her office and entered the view of her underlings, Brit the Much Elder's entire demeanor changed. She took on an air of frosty competence, as if she would judge you for the slightest error and would do a much more professional, efficient job of judging you than anyone else could. They walked past a desk where a man in his late 20s, wearing an inexpensive suit that fit poorly in all the wrong places, said,
"Director Ryan, you have an appointment in 10 minutes. Should I tell them you'll be delayed?"
She didn't bother to look back as she answered,
"No, Robbins. I should be back well before then."
They entered a large rectangular room with a small forest of pillars, seemingly supporting the low acoustic tile ceiling and fluorescent lights. Cubicle walls chopped the space up into a grid. The communal sound of people shuffling papers, muttering softly, and generally trying to be quiet filled the air.
"What do you do here?"
Philip asked.
"I run a task force for the Department of Justice. We monitor and investigate all of the various cases that the FBI, the CIA, and various state and local law enforcement agencies deem too inexplicable, unlikely, or just plain stupid for them to sully their hands with. Aliens. Bigfoot sightings?" She turned and arched an eyebrow at Philip. Reports of people with magical powers, claims of time travelers, that sort of thing.
How'd you get this job?
Philip asked, trying to hide the genuine interest and enthusiasm in his voice. As the person in charge of investigating magic and time travel, she was in a perfect position to prevent the exposure of people like her. I worked my way up, then volunteered for this posting. Most of the other bureaucrats at my level consider this place career suicide. They don't like the idea of having their resume include several years spent trying to prove the unprovable. I wanted the job, though. I have an affinity for this stuff, as you might imagine. Unfortunately, we've yet to come up with any concrete evidence to prove anything because, as we know, magic and time travel don't exist. She turned and winked at Philip. Before Philip could respond, a woman in a beige business suit approached and matched speed with Britt the much elder.
Director Ryan, thank you for talking to them personally, but my field team still wants to move on their target.
Britt the much elder shook her head. I know they do. I've spoken to them personally about it.
Sorry, ma'am.
Not your fault, Saunders. You tell them that we'll contact them if their orders change. Until that happens, they're to hold tight and just observe. I know that the subject played them for fools, and they want payback. But just because they made a mistake before, that doesn't mean they should be hasty and make another mistake now.
Yes, ma'am. Do you want me to tell them the part about them getting played for fools and making mistakes?
If you're talking to Miller, yes. If it's Murphy, be kinder about it. That poor man puts up with enough as it is.
Yes, ma'am.
The woman in the beige suit sped away. Britt the much elder glanced back at Philip again. Sorry about that. Business. You understand.
Anyway, I've set you up a workspace in a vacant office right over here.
She held a door open and directed Philip to enter. Inside, Philip found two desks, two beat-up rolling office chairs, and two equally beat-up office-grade PC workstations. Britt the much elder closed and locked the office door behind herself. A few seconds later, Britt the Elder materialized, wearing her UGG boots and the same crisp black suit Britt the Much Elder had on.
You look very nice, Britt the Much Elder said.
I'm not surprised you think so, Britt the Elder replied.
When did you borrow my suit?
Yesterday.
Of course.
Wait, I had it laundered last week, that me-
Ew, I'm wearing your dirty clothes.
That's right. Britt the Much Elder shuddered in revulsion. I know we're the same person, but still, ew, Britt the Elder said.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
Yeah, I know. Okay, I've got a meeting in 5, then I'm going home to take a long bath. You two should be fine here. I'm locking the door and I have the only key, so you won't be disturbed. Britt, if someone does get a glimpse of you, just snarl at them until they run for it. With that, Britt the Much Elder disappeared.
So,
Philip asked.
What are we going to do?
Exactly what she said. Research, to start with. The Atlantis interface keeps a record of any time someone uses it to perform magic. I've downloaded the last 20 years' worth of logs, millions of lines of it. The task force has access to some advanced search tools. You're going to use those tools to look for anything that might be an anomaly, anything that looks like part of the glitch, or might have caused it.
Okay. And you?
Britt the Elder said. I'll be going through every daily journal entry Britt the Younger has written up until this point, looking for any clues as to what went wrong and when. Philip blinked at Britt the Elder.
Britt the Younger keeps a journal?
Religiously.
Is it detailed?
Obsessively.
She never told me.
Obviously.
Does she talk about me in them?
Extensively.
Well, then, if there are that many journal entries, maybe it would be faster if we both go through the journals. Then if we don't find anything, we can move on to the logs.
No, I'll handle the journals. You'll stick to the logs. When you're done with the last 20 years, I'll give you the 20 before.
But, I just think it'd be better if we both look through the journals. I might see something you don't.
Maybe, Britt the Elder said. But you'd see everything that's written in the journals, and none of us want that.
I do.
I wasn't talking about you. When I said us, I meant me and the other two Brits. 13.
Miller sat in a different rental car, parked in the same parking spot, glaring sideways at the entrance of the luxurious Rothschild building across the street. The building was directly in front of him. He needed to look at it sideways because he'd resorted to exhaling directly out of the open driver's side window to keep the windshield from completely fogging over. The plan worked, in that the driver's side of the windshield had only partially fogged over. The passenger side door opened and his partner Murphy slid into the car, shaking his head. He tossed a banana back over his shoulder. It landed on a pile of bananas that covered most of the back seat. Swapping out the rental agency's cheapest, most run-down car for their second cheapest, second most run-down car did nothing to stem the banana tide. Murphy had started checking the exhaust pipe every 10 minutes or so, and found a new one there every time he checked. Miller suspected that the bananas replaced themselves a minute or two after one was removed, and told Murphy as much, but Murphy still insisted on checking, trying to see how many bananas he could collect by the end of the day. Murphy said, "At least we won't be hurting for snacks." Miller glared at him. "Seriously, though," Murphy said, picking his laptop up from the car's floor and placing it in his lap. "We should swing by a homeless shelter at some point and donate all these bananas. Some good might as well come of this."
"Really? You think anybody'd want to eat our magic tailpipe bananas?"
"Not if we call them that."
Miller shook his head.
"Why won't they let us move in? Sadler's a known fugitive. It's not like we're going to learn anything from watching him. He's obviously on to us. He's not going to show us anything he doesn't want us to see. This is pointless."
"Probably they figure that if we move in, he'll just get away. And then we'll have to track him down again. But if you and I keep watching him and he keeps messing with us, at least we still know where he is."
"Yeah," Miller said. "That's probably it."
"I think so."
"It's completely unfair to us and insulting."
"That's why it rings so true."
Miller leaned forward, his eyes wide and his mouth contorted into what an observer might have mistaken for a smile. In fact, he was baring his teeth.
"He's on the move."
Murphy squinted through the windshield, but his side was fogged in completely. He gave up, said,
"Fine, I'll go get the banana,"
and again stepped out of the car. Miller watched, almost salivating, as Jimmy Sadler made small talk with the doorman. Instead of his usual dark sport coat and khakis, Jimmy wore a red nylon windbreaker with an ad for some place called Sporto's Tavern and Slot Emporium silk-screened on the back. He and the doorman shared a laugh, then Jimmy stepped out onto the sidewalk, and instead of turning left to go to the parking lot, turned right and started walking down the street. Murphy stepped back into the car.
"There wasn't a new one yet. We're good to go, if we must."
"We must," Miller said, starting the car.
He turned on the left turn indicator and started frantically head-checking, looking for any opportunity to get across the near lane of traffic and into the far lane, headed the same direction as Jimmy.
"What are you doing?"
Murphy asked, peering through a clear spot he'd wiped in the condensation on the windshield.
"Why the left?"
"He didn't go to his car. I think he's trying to throw us off. That's why he's dressed so weird."
"I see what you mean about the outfit. But we don't know yet if he's going to the car or not."
"What? You think he's going to walk all the way around the block?"
"Miller, what are you talking about? He's walking toward his car."
Miller kept his eyes glued to Jimmy, who was still walking away from the building in the opposite direction from the parking lot.
"I'm looking at him right here, and he's not anywhere near his car."
"No," Murphy said. "You're looking at the wrong guy. I've got him, and he's not walking very fast, but he's headed toward the parking lot. Here, look."
Miller whipped his head to the left and the right, looking for holes in the traffic in both directions and trying to keep an eye on Jimmy.
"No, Murph. I gotta drive the car and keep track of Sadler. Would you please get with the program? He's almost to the corner."
"No, he's almost to the parking lot. And he's acting weird. I'm not taking my eyes off of him."
Miller thought he saw a hole in the far lane. As he swiveled his head to look at the oncoming traffic, his eyes cast over a figure wearing a denim jacket, flannel shirt, and skinny jeans, in a slightly different shade of denim than the jacket. Miller did a double take, but on the second look he couldn't deny it was Jimmy. He looked back to the first person he thought was Jimmy, and saw Jimmy wearing his tavern jacket and lighting a cigarette as he waited for the light to change. He was sure it was Jimmy. He looked back to the guy in the Canadian tuxedo and was convinced that it was also Jimmy. Murphy said,
"What the hell? There's another Jimmy."
"Yeah,"
Miller said,
The one I saw.
No, further down, a third Jimmy.
Jimmy came strutting up the sidewalk, wearing a puffy green insulated vest and cargo pants. He and the Jimmy in the denim nodded hello as they passed each other. Miller gasped,
"What the hell?"
The car sputtered and died. Neither of the agents cared. As the Jimmy in the puffy vest walked past the car,